She repeated the announcement immediately in fluent German, and then in less proficient but clearly intelligible French, before reverting to English once again. Officers of the Action Commando will wear red shirts for immediate identification, and they will be armed. As she spoke, her three companions in the front of the first-class cabin were stripping out the false bottoms from their canvas flight bags. The space was only 2 inches deep by 14 by 8, but it was sufficient for the broken-down 12-bore pistols and 10 rounds of buckshot cartridges. The barrels of the pistols were 14 inches long. The bores were smooth and made of armoured plastic. The material would not have withstood the passage of a solid bullet through rifling or any of the newer explosive propellants, but it had been designed for use with the lower velocity and pressures of multiple shot and cordite. The breech piece was of plastic, as were the double pistol grips, and these clipped swiftly into position. The only metal in the entire weapon was the case steel firing pin and spring, no bigger than one of the metal studs in the canvas flight bag, so they would not have activated the metal detectors of the security check at Marhay Airport. The 10 cartridges contained in each bag had plastic cases and bases. Again, only the percussion caps were of aluminium foil, which would not disturb an electrical field. The cartridges were packed in looped cartridge belts, which buckled around the waist. The weapons were short, black, and ugly. They required reloading like a conventional shotgun. The spent shells were not self-ejecting, and the recoil was so vicious that it would break the wrists of the user who did not bear down heavily on the pistol grips. However, at ranges up to 30 feet, the destructive power was awesome. At 12 feet it would disembowel a man, and at 6 feet it would blow his head off cleanly. Yet it did not have the penetrating power to hole the pressure hull of an intercontinental airliner. It was the perfect weapon for the job in hand. And within a few seconds, 3 of them had been assembled and loaded, and the 2 men had slipped on the bright scarlet shirts that identified them over their T-shirts and moved to their positions, one in the back of the first-class cabin and one at the back of the tourist cabin. They stood with their grotesque weapons ostentatiously displayed. The slim, pretty, dark-haired German girl stayed in her seat a little longer, working swiftly and neatly as she opened the remaining cocoa demure and transferred their contents into 2 of the netting bags. These grenades differed only from the one carried by Ingrid in that they had double red lines painted round the middle. This signified that they were electronically fused. Now Ingrid's clear young voice resumed over the cabin address system, and the long rows of passengers, all fully awake now, sat rigid and attentive, their faces reflecting an almost uniform expression of shock and trepidation. The officer of the Action Commando who is moving down the cabin at this time is placing high explosive grenades. The dark-haired girl started down the aisle, and every 15 rows she opened one of the overhead lockers and placed a grenade in it, closed the locker, and moved on. The passengers' heads revolved slowly in unison as they watched her with a fascination of total horror. A single one of these grenades has the explosive power to destroy this aircraft. They were designed to kill by concussion the crew of a battle tank protected by 6 inches of armor. The officer is placing 14 of these devices along the length of this aircraft. They can be detonated simultaneously by an electronic transmitter under my control. The voice contained a hint of mischief now, a little undercurrent of laughter. And if that happened, they'd hear the bang at the North Pole. The passengers stirred like the leaves of a tree in a vagrant breeze. Somewhere a woman began to weep. It was a strangled, passionless sound, and nobody even looked in her direction. But don't worry yourselves, that isn't going to happen, because everybody is going to do exactly as they are told. And when it's all over, you're going to be proud of your part in this operation. We are all partners in a noble and glorious mission. We are all warriors for freedom and for the dignity of man. Today we take a mighty step forward into the new world, a world purged and cleansed of injustice and tyranny, and dedicated to the welfare of all its peoples. The woman was still weeping, and now a child joined her on a higher, more strident note. The dark-haired girl returned to her seat, and now she retrieved the camera that had activated the metal detector at Marhay Airport. She slung it around her neck and crouched again to assemble the two remaining shot pistols. Carrying them and the cartridge belts, she hurried forward to the flight deck, where the big blonde kissed her delightedly and unashamedly on the lips. "Karen Liebling, you were wonderful." And then she took the camera from her and slung it around her own neck. "This," she explained to the captain, "is not what it appears to be. It is the remote radio detonator for the grenades in the fuselage." He nodded without replying, and with obvious relief, Ingrid disarmed the grenade that she had carried for so long by replacing the safety pin. She handed it to the other girl. "How much longer to the coast?" she asked as she strapped and buckled the cartridge belt around her waist. 32 minutes, said the flight engineer promptly, and Ingrid opened the breech of the pistol, checked the load, and then snapped it closed again. "You and Henri can stand down now," she told Karen. "Try and sleep." The operation might last many days still, and exhaustion would be the most dangerous enemy they would have to contend with. It was for this reason alone that they had employed such a large force. From now on, except in an emergency, two of them would be on duty and two would be resting. "You've done a very professional job," said the pilot, Cyril Watkins. "So far." "Thank you," Ingrid laughed, and over the back of his seat placed a comradely hand on his shoulder. "We've practiced very hard for this day." Peter Stride dipped his lights 3 times as he raced down the long, narrow alley that led to the gates of the compound, without slowing the rover, and the sentry swung the gate open just in time for him to roar through. There were no floodlights, no bustling activity, just the 2 aircraft standing together in the echoing cavern of the hangar. The Lockheed Hercules seemed to fill the entire building that had been built to accommodate the smaller bombers of World War II. The tall vertical fin of its épinage reached to within a few feet of the roof girders. Beside it, the Hawker Siddeley HS-125 executive jet seemed dainty and ineffectual. The differing origins of the machines emphasized that this unit was a cooperative venture between 2 nations. This was underscored once more when Colin Noble hurried forward to meet Peter as he cut the rover's engine and lights. "A grand night for it, Peter." There was no mistaking the drawl of Midwestern America, although Colin looked more like a successful used car salesman than a colonel in the U.S. Marines. In the beginning, Peter had believed that this strict apportioning of material and manpower on equal national lines might weaken the effectiveness of Atlas. He no longer had those doubts. Colin wore the nondescript blue overalls and cloth cap, both embroidered with the legend Thor Communications, which deliberately made him look more of a technician than a soldier. Colin was Peter's second in command. They had known each other only the 6 weeks since Peter had assumed command of Thor, but after a short period of mutual wariness, the 2 men had formed one of those fast bonds of liking and mutual respect. Colin was of medium height, but nonetheless a big man. First glance might have given the impression that he was fat, for his body had a certain toad-like spread to it. There was no fat upon his frame, however. It was all muscle and bone. He had boxed heavyweight for Princeton and the Marines, and his nose above the wide laughing mouth had been broken just below the bridge. It was lumped and twisted slightly. Colin cultivated the boisterous, bluff manner of a career athlete, but his eyes were the colour of burnt toffee and were brightly intelligent and all-seeing. He was tough and leery as an old alley cat. It was not easy to earn the respect of Peter Stride. Colin had done so in under 6 weeks. He stood now between the 2 aircraft, while his men went about their alpha preparation with quick, understated efficiency. Both aircraft were painted in commercial airline style, blue and white and gold, with a stylized portrait of the Thunder God on the tail fin and the Thor Communications title down the fuselage. They could land at any airport in the world without causing undue comment. "What's the buzz, Colin?" Peter Stride demanded as he slammed the rover's door and hurried to meet the American. It had taken him some time and conscious effort to adapt his language and mode of address to fit in with his new second-in-command. He had learned very early not to expect that merely because he was the youngest major general in the British Army, Colonel Colin Noble was going to call him Sir every time he spoke. "Missing aircraft." It could have been a train, an embassy, Even an ocean liner, Peter realized. British Airways, for Christ's sake, let's get out of the cold. The wind was flapping the legs of Colin's overalls and tugging at his sleeves. Where? Indian Ocean. Are we set for Bravo? Peter asked as they climbed into his command plane. All set. The interior of the Hawker had been restyled to make it a compact headquarters and communications center. There was comfortable seating for four officers directly behind the flight deck. Then the two electronic engineers and their equipment occupied a separate rear compartment, beyond which were the small toilet and galley in the extreme rear. One of the technicians looked through the communicating door as Peter stooped into the cabin. Good evening, General Stride. We have a direct link with Atlas established. Put him on the screen, he ordered, as he sank into the padded leather of his chair behind the small working desk. There was a single 14-inch main television screen in the panel directly facing Peter, and above it four smaller 6-inch screens for conference communication. The main screen came alive, and the image of the big, noble leonine head firmed. Good afternoon, Peter. The smile was warm, charismatic, compelling. Good evening, sir. And Dr. Kingston Parker tilted his head slightly to acknowledge the reference to the time difference between Washington and England. Right at this moment, we are in the dark completely. All we have is that BA-070, with 401 passengers and 16 crew, on a flight from Mahay to Nairobi, has not reported for 32 minutes. Parker was chairman of the Intelligence Oversight Board, among other duties, and he reported directly to the President of the United States in that capacity. He was the President's personal and trusted friend. They had been in the same class at Annapolis. Both of them had graduated in the top 20, but unlike the President, Parker had gone directly into government. Parker was an artist, a talented musician, the author of four scholarly works of philosophy and politics, and a grandmaster of chess. A man of overwhelming presence, of vast humanity and towering intelligence. Yet also he was a secret man, avoiding the glaring scrutiny of the media, hiding his ambitions, if ambitions he had, although the presidency of the United States would not be an impossible dream to such a man, only taking up with rare skill and strength any burden that was thrust upon him. Peter Stride had met him personally on half a dozen occasions since being seconded to Thor. He had spent a weekend with Parker at his New York home, and his respect for the man had become boundless. Peter realized that he was the perfect head for such a complex concept as Atlas. It needed the philosopher's tempering influence over trained soldiers. It needed the tact and charisma of the diplomat to deal directly with the heads of two governments. And it needed that steely intellect to make the ultimate decision that could involve hundreds of innocent lives and incur fearsome political consequences. Now, swiftly and incisively, he told Peter what little they knew of Flight 070 and what search and rescue routine was already in force before going on. Without being alarmist, this does seem to be the perfect target. The flight carries most of the world's leading surgeons, and the convention was public knowledge 18 months ago. Doctors have the necessary image to appeal to public sentiment, and their nationalities are nicely mixed: American, British, French, Scandinavian, German, Italian. Three of those countries have notoriously soft records with militant activity. It's a British aircraft, and the final destination would probably have been chosen to further complicate the issue and inhibit any counteraction. Parker paused, and a small crease of worry appeared for a moment in the broad, smooth forehead. I have put Mercury on condition Alpha as well. If this is a strike, the final destination could just as easily be eastwards of the aircraft's last reported position.